A failed summit and its financial market fallout. This is the Marketplace Morning Report, live from the BBC World Service. I'm Anu Anand. Good morning. Sometimes you have to walk, and this was one of those times. That's how President Trump explained the early end to his second summit in North Korea's Kim Jong-un today in Hanoi. The move sent ructions through South Korea's markets, as the BBC's Will Bain reports.
South Korea's benchmark share index shed 1.8%, its biggest one-day percentage decline since October 2018. Shares of construction and equipment makers were hardest hit. Those are sensitive to closer economic ties between North and South Korea. The country's currency, the won, meanwhile weakened, while the yield on South Korea's benchmark bond rose as prices fell. The moves came shortly after a signing ceremony, scheduled for later today, was cancelled after the United States refused North Korean demands for sanctions relief. Mr. Trump told journalists in Vietnam, where the summit was held, Mr. Kim wanted sanctions to be lifted entirely, but there wasn't enough progress on denuclearization for the US to agree. The US president added Mr. Kim vowed not to return to nuclear weapons and long-range missile testing and was confident an agreement could be reached in time. In London, I'm the BBC's Will Bain for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. The news out of Hanoi is weighing on global shares. Worries over U.S.-China trade are adding to sour sentiment. America's chief trade negotiator warned longer-term enforcement challenges remain. And fresh figures show China factory activity contracted for the third straight month in February. Now, world leaders, including President Trump, are trying to reduce tensions between India and Pakistan. The economic repercussions of renewed conflict, sparked by recent aerial attacks across the disputed border of the two countries, are also being felt globally. Flights were cancelled or rerouted after Pakistan closed its airspace. 800 flights a day use that corridor. Meanwhile, Khurram Hussain, business editor of the Dawn newspaper, explains the economic fallout between the two countries.
Trade between India and Pakistan consists largely of agricultural products. It's not very large, the amount, especially not considering the size of India's external trade.
And that's kind of the point, isn't it? I mean, they're neighbors. They've been in dispute for more than 70 years. And yet this trickle of trade continues. And the volume of that trade did grow this fiscal year.
Yes, the volume of the trade did grow by about 5%. But you're absolutely right that the level of intra-regional trade overall within South Asia is amongst the lowest in the region, if not the very lowest. And India and Pakistan rank particularly high in terms of diminished levels of trade there is between them, which is a huge handicap, especially for Pakistan, because it's the smaller economy and it's smaller economies that tend to benefit more from trade with larger economies.
What's the potential for trade between the two countries?
Food items were the original bulk of the trade between India and Pakistan before the trade was shut down in 1965. Since then, Pakistan has become self-sufficient in food, but there is now a huge potential for industrial chemicals, for instance, or for raw materials or precursor chemicals for the pharmaceutical industry.
So who is Pakistan's biggest trading partner at the moment? And is the key to unlocking more growth in the country more trade with India?
Increased trade with India is definitely one of the keys to unlocking growth. Pakistan's growth rate has averaged somewhere in the area of 4% for the past decade. Pakistan currently, its largest trading partners are actually distant countries. For instance, China has become the largest exporter to Pakistan. And after that, the United States and the European Union are big destinations for Pakistan's exports.
Khurram Hussain. Now, I'm guessing it's mostly bills and flyers in your mailbox, unless you're into subscription boxes that are tailored to your interests. The concept has taken off with consumers, but the BBC's Victoria Craig examines how long it can last.
10 years into the craze, and with a box to fit every want and need, have we reached peak subscription box?
Welcome back to my channel, Life in High Definition.
Vivian Harewood-Drake is a British video blogger with an insatiable appetite for the monthly deliveries.
I am definitely a serial subscriber. When I started just over a year ago, I was just a sort of trying and dipping my toe in the water. But the more I discovered, the more I got into it.
She spends about $90 a month on 7 to 8 subscription boxes.
Even if you only get one box a month, which is quite normal for most people, that's a nice little treat that you know is coming through the door, something that's going to put a smile on your face, and it's a little bit of something for you.
And Vivian isn't alone in her love of the trend. Last year, data from consultancy McKinsey showed the subscription box market swelled to a $10 billion business in the U.S., while Hitwise figures indicate online search interest in the U.K. grew 26%. So as subscribers continue to make the mundane task of getting the mail just a a little bit more fun. Have we hit a saturation point? Ken Fenyo, head of the consumer markets team at McKinsey, says not by a long shot.
There'll be, you know, a next wave of businesses where it's not just a matter of trying to find some niche that no one else is doing, but what's the next enhancement on the set of services that brings new value.
UK-based snacks company Graze is already embracing the idea as industry giants realize the benefits of subscription models. Graze this month announced it's being acquired by Unilever, whose direct-to-consumer category reportedly accounted for only 5% of revenues last year. That's after spending $1 billion to add US-based Dollar Shave Club to its portfolio in 2016. At his company's headquarters in London, Graze boss Anthony Fletcher explains why this consumer-focused model, one that big brands really want to use to draw more consumer loyalty, works.
So Graze's big breakthrough maybe 8 or 9 years ago is when we targeted the office. Lots of people really noticed the product and then signed up themselves. I think this is something I'm convinced on. If you're an entrepreneur, you should start direct to consumer. You get far more feedback from your consumer and it lets you really perfect your product before you roll it out. I think it's a completely different mindset to the traditional way that companies used to develop products.
In the end, it all comes down to consumer tastes. And for subscribers like Vivian...
Let's see what we've got in here. Getting a little treat through the post is quite a good little boost.
It's the surprise and simplicity that keeps them coming back for more. In London, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
And I'm Anu Anand, coming to you live from the BBC World Service with the Marketplace Morning Report.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.